and she has an article at N Plus One magazine, from the lockdown protest to the Capitol January 6th and the enduring lesson of Black Lives Matter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vanessa Wills.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's an article in The Guardian that reveals that of the 14 Californians charged in connection with the pro-Trump riot on January the 6th, three are from the wealthy Los Angeles enclave of Beverly Hills, including Gina Bisignano, a salon owner, and Simone Gold, who is she's an emergency room physician and the founder of a group called America's Frontline Doctors, along with John Strand. And this sort of raises the question of the nature of Trump's base. We were always told, going back to 2016, that this was largely the sort of disaffected white working class. But even the analysis of who voted for him in 2016 has never been clear that that is really the biggest constituency. And now we're looking at the very people who made the last-ditch effort in a coup against the majority of Americans. 81 million Americans voted for Joe Biden, and the attempt was to literally take away 81 million votes and install Trump. So going back to 2016, do you think we ever got a proper glimpse of who really is the constituency that supports Trump? And I guess you're arguing that it's less white working class, more sort of petty bourgeois small business.
Yeah, so I think we do have data that tells us that the sort of stronghold of his support is a huge mass of solidarity, you know, with Trump and with his message and with his program, coming from affluent white people. So not necessarily the big bourgeoisie, CEOs of companies, of large corporations, although there's some of that. And he certainly did have support among some working class white people and lower income folks. But when we look at the core of his support, it comes from this layer that not enough is said about, which is small business owners, as you said, petty bourgeois, fairly affluent, sort of upper middle income, right? People who are relatively financially comfortable, but feel precarious in that comfort and are concerned that they will be sort of knocked out of this position.
So in other words, the couple in St. Louis who pointed guns at the Black Lives Matter protesters, they would be more like the median Trump supporters?
I think that's exactly right. And also there is this, there's a kind of important nuance here, because we have the numbers that tell us about who is voting for Trump, and we find that he has disproportionately much support among this kind of layer. But then there's also the question of who is represented by his politics, whose interests are best represented by the kinds of things that Trump and Trumpism is about. And I think that's where it's so important to look, for example, at the connections between the coup attempt on January 6th, which we know it grew out of these protests happening throughout the summer, these lockdown protests, where we had groups of folks organizing to protest masking efforts, policies that were meant to limit the spread of corona by enforcing social distancing and so on. And we know who was there as well. We know that these were also highly overrepresented by small business owners. So oftentimes the groups that organize these would self-identify, right? We are small business owners and we are being crushed by these policies that are coming from big business and big government. And so that, okay, so that's one kind of direction of pressure. But then there's a question, well, there's a lot of people who are experiencing economic hardship, who have experienced all kinds of privation that has been intensified in the midst of this pandemic, which has been mishandled, right? Why don't these folks join together with the millions of Americans who, for example, were out in Black Lives Matter protests, were arguing that we need to move funding from these incredibly overgrown police departments and militarized police departments into social programs. And for that, we really need an analysis of this very specific petty bourgeois small business position, where there is a sense of a threat coming from the working class, right? That the kinds of things that are going to be good for working people, like, for example, having unemployment benefits that allow people to stay home and stay home from their jobs in salons, right? And, you know, and these kinds of spas and places of this nature, those things are then regarded as a threat. And so the question is, who represents a politics that is both positioning itself, posturing as some kind of anti-tyranny, anti-big government politics, but also is positioning itself as a politics that is really counter to the interests of the masses of people, to the interests of working people, right? And so there's the question of the numbers of who's voting for Trump, but also this specific question of who, you know, cui bono, right? Who sees themselves as benefiting from this particular kind of politics?
And again, I'm speaking with Vanessa Wills, who's a political philosopher, ethicist, educator, and activist working in Washington, D.C. She's an assistant professor of philosophy at George Washington University and recently was a visiting chair in ethics and practice at Ludwig Maximilian Universität Munich's Center for Ethics. Her areas of specialization are moral, social, and political philosophy, 19th century German philosophy, especially Karl Marx, and the philosophy of race. And she has an article at N+1 magazine, From the Lockdown Protest to the Capitol, January the 6th, and the Enduring Lesson of Black Lives Matter. So not only then, I mean, obviously, I've covered the rallies that Trump took, and there was a journalist who wrote a really amusing book who sort of embedded himself with the crowds. They were kind of like camp followers. They just followed him around the country, and many of them, I think, showed up. There's that core, and then you've got the character with the Viking horns, etc.
Yes.
They, of course, attracted the cameras, and they, of course, gravitate to the cameras. But what you're pointing out is that there's an awful lot of middle-class small business owners. Ashley Babbitt, who died storming the Capitol lobby, she was a small business owner from San Diego, and some of them, I think, showed up in private jets, as a matter of fact.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about the funding from the Koch brothers, the DeVos families, the Mercers, and the Dahl brothers. I've been trying to look into that. Do you have any idea of how? Because I understood that Rebecca Mercer, for example, funded through a women's right-wing women's group a lot of the travel and hotel rooms for the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers.
Yes, when we look at the funding, it also speaks to the its source in these kinds of right-wing funding sources. So the Dahl brothers, for example, they're interesting because they themselves are sort of small business petty grifters who have a sort of small cottage industry out of sort of ginning up controversy around these right-wing causes. So, for example, they were very active around the Tea Party. They've been active around pro-life organizing. And they harvest data from people who say, oh, yes, you know, I'm pro-life and I want to be involved in this, or people that they run into at protests. And they then sell the data. They sell it to campaigns and so on. So this is a business for them. It's a business model. And one of the things that was first extremely striking, you know, to me and to others is when the lockdown protests first began to pop up on social media as events that were being promoted and Facebook groups being organized, they looked very similar from city to city to city or from state to state. And so the question is, well, that's the sort of interesting, right, that they look so similar. And it turns out that many of them, you know, had in fact been seeded by the Dorr brothers, right, that they had set up these projects all around the country in these different states. And yes, there's links to the DeVos family, links to the Koch brothers, although the Koch brothers have sort of distance themselves from some of this. Within their apparatus, there are people who are involved in distributing Koch money who have also been linked, right, to the lockdown protests. And so what you have is really this combination of this kind of right-wing element of the petty bourgeoisie, because of course it's not all small business owners, right, that are engaged in this, but it's a right-wing reactionary element within the petty bourgeoisie that finds links with the most kind of right-wing reactionary elements of the big bourgeoisie, right, we think of billionaires and so on. When we look at the funding, that's what we find.
Well, one of the biggest right-wing grifters is Alex Jones of InfoWars. Mm-hmm. And he has claimed that Trump invited him to Washington prior to the January the 6th, and he was paid $500,000 to help organize it. He also mentioned that Roger Stone had been down in Florida around the beginning of January for a few days at Mar-a-Lago with Trump, where they were hatching plans. So Do you think that there will be any more revelations about how this thing was organized and planned? Because, for example, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, they had a big rally in Washington in November, and then I think then another one on December the 12th, which seemed kind of like rehearsals for what happened on January the 6th. They had lots of clashes with overwhelmed police, and they stabbed a lot of Black Lives Matter people into the night. It just feels to me like we haven't even begun to look into this, the origins of this thing, and who really was organizing it. This wasn't a spontaneous event.
It was not. And I think that's exactly right, that there's so much work to be done to really look at the networks and the folks involved. But then I think there's also these sort of broader dynamics, right? Because we have the folks that showed up on January 6th, you know, ready to wreak havoc. But we also have these larger phenomena of things like QAnon conspiracy theory, right? Of course, the Stop the Steal idea was itself a conspiracy theory, right? And so we have these larger problems of a kind of flight from reason, right? Flight from rationality and turning to these sort of mythological conspiracy and lore, right, that spread. And so we've talked a lot about the idea of fake news, which of course comes from Trump, right? And but also the reaction has been to think about, well, how has social media, how has our public sphere been structured in a way that has been conducive to this disinformation, this kind of really scrambling, right, of people's ability to assess facts properly. And in addition to that, right, we have the fact that the response right now from the Biden administration and from liberal quarters in general is to use a larger police state, right, is to argue that what we need is to give more powers of surveillance to the FBI. Right now, around the Capitol building and in the blocks surrounding it, there has been this massive wall separating it. And that, I think, presents its own danger. It can seem appealing, right, to say, well, what we need to do is to crack down on certain kinds of public discourse. What we need to do is to build up the police state. But one of the other things that we know about who was there on January 6th was that there was quite a, maybe surprising to some, number of police officers who were part of the insurrectionary effort, right? And former military. Ashley Babbitt, who you mentioned a moment ago, right, is somebody who sort of checks both of these boxes, not only a business owner of a struggling business, but also former military. So we know that these various kinds of apparatuses that are designed to mete out state violence, there's overlap and interaction and intersection between these forces and the people who were trying to overthrow the results of the election. There seems to, you know, when we talk about coordination, right, there seems to have been some coordination there as well. So the idea that we're going to police our way out of this kind of threat of authoritarianism, right, or police our way out of, you know, this kind of burgeoning fascist movement, I think is, you know, first of all, wrong. It's not going to work. And second of all, extremely dangerous, because we risk strengthening exactly these elements that are so dangerous at this moment, and weakening the left, weakening the mass movements that can do, you know, two things, right? One is to put forward a different set of politics in response to the real suffering that people are experiencing, and two, that, you know, it's left wing organizing, it's anti-fascist, it is grassroots movements that tend to actually be the most effective in countering these kinds of fascist, right wing, white terrorist elements on the ground.
Well, Vanessa Wills, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Vanessa Wills, who's a political philosopher, ethicist, educator, and activist working in Washington, D.C. She's an assistant professor of philosophy at George Washington University and was recently a visiting chair in ethics and the practice at Ludwig Maximilian Universitat's Munich Center for Ethics. And her areas of specialization are moral, social, and political philosophy, 19th century German philosophy, especially Karl Marx, and the philosophy of race. And she has an article at N+1 magazine, From the Lockdown Protest to the Capitol, January the 6th, and the Enduring Lessons of Black Lives Matter. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a follow-up on the expected release today of the declassified report from the DNI on the murder of Khashoggi, which is apparently delayed because President Biden can't get the Saudi king on the phone.
You try so hard, but you don't understand just what you will say when you get home. Because something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones?
Now the king told the boogeyman, you have to let that rocket drop. The oil down the desert way has been shaken to the top. The shaky drove his Cadillac. He went cruising down the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Lee Whitson, who is Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, DAWN, a U.S. organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi shortly before his murder. DAWN and Khashoggi's widow have an active civil suit against Mohammed bin Salman for Khashoggi's murder. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Lee Whitson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, and I promised our audience we'd be talking about the declassification of the intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community investigation into the murder of Khashoggi and who was responsible for it, but it hasn't happened, right? So what are you hearing as to why this declassification that was promised today of this report has been held up?
What we're hearing is that President Biden said that he wanted to talk to King Salman before the releasing, before the release of the report. And what we've also heard is that the Biden administration made numerous attempts to schedule a call with the king, but that for unknown reasons, the king has not been available for this call. The final thing I've heard is that the Biden administration has given them a 24-hour deadline to have an opportunity to have this conversation before they release the report regardless.
So what do you think is happening at the Saudi end, since the boy king is really in charge? And the rumor is that the 86-year-old father, the king, who Biden is trying to get in touch with and apparently can't, which is pretty strange in itself, could MBS be pulling the strings there? What do you think's going on? It doesn't make a lot of sense that a head of state would not be able to take a phone call from the American president.
Well, you know, the Saudis are masters at bungling and making things worse, just as their incessant lies and avoidance created a global theater around the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and, you know, their inane denials and then trotting out someone dressed as a body double, etc. In the same way, they have turned the release of the DNI report into global theater with this absurd telephone avoidance. You know, why the king isn't answering the phone, you know, we're all left to speculate. Is it because he has dementia and can't come to the phone? Is it because his son is not even letting him know that the U.S. is trying to reach him, or is locking him up in a room to avoid the news reaching his father, such that the king might turn around and dismiss him as crown prince? We really don't know. I mean, we also know that there was an announcement saying that Mohammed bin Salman just left the hospital on Wednesday following an appendicitis surgery. So that might have been a ploy or an effort or an opportunity to buy more time by the Saudis. But of course, the irony is that prolonging this conversation and the release of the report is only heightening the anticipation for what it actually says, and the incessant 24/7 media coverage about the murder of Khashoggi. And yet again, the Saudi government's effort to deny, hide, shuffle, and generally avoid the topic.
But it's hard to believe, though, Sarah, that the Saudis don't recognize that something's happening at the American end, because what, it's over a week ago that the Biden's press secretary said that Biden was recalibrating the relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that he would only talk from leader to leader and counterpart to counterpart, and therefore he would talk to King Salman, and that MBS would have to communicate with the Secretary of Defense.
I mean, certainly it's true, but at the same time, the Biden administration has tried to talk out of both sides of its mouth. I mean, certainly it's legitimate for Biden to say that he'll speak to the king and the king is the head of state and not the crown prince. That is, in fact, entirely appropriate. And what wasn't appropriate was President Trump's treating the crown prince as the head of state, despite the fact that he could be removed at any time by the king. But at the same time, the day after those remarks were made by Jen Psaki, the next day we had our Minister of Defense, the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, putting out a statement confirming that he talked to MBS. And while we had Biden announcing that he was ending offensive weapon sales and support for the war in Yemen, there was a falling over themselves reassurance to Saudi Arabia that we were going to continue providing them defensive weapons. And of course, that is the reason why Congressman Rouhana and I believe 35-40 other Congress members today released a letter that Don is a signatory and endorser of, demanding that the Biden administration actually explain just what the hell that means, particularly in the hands of a government that launched a so-called preemptive war in Yemen. I mean, claiming that it was a preemptive defensive war. So then what does it mean to sell a government like that defensive weapons?
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Lee Whitson, who's Executive Director of the Democracy for the Arab World Now, Dawn, a U.S. organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi shortly before his murder. Dawn and Khashoggi's widow have an active civil suit against MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, for Khashoggi's murder. And we're talking about how today we're expecting the declassified intelligence report by the Director of National Intelligence into the investigation of the murder of Khashoggi and who was responsible for it. And that has been delayed, ostensibly, as Sarah has told us, because Biden can't get through to the king. So, go figure. The excuse, of course, that MBS has is that he sort of did a limited mea culpa and said, well, I'm responsible, but I didn't really order it. My subordinates did it and they were off the reservation or whatever. Is that going to be the response to this report whenever it reaches the public?
Well, if the report is revealing the evidence that we expect, which is the text intercepts of MBS's communications with Saud al-Qahtani, his chief advisor, talking about ordering the killing and securing the killing, followed by real-time monitoring and reports between Qahtani and the henchmen carrying out the crime in Istanbul, and then, of course, capped off by reports back from Qahtani to MBS about the deed having been done, that argument, of course, isn't going to persuade anyone, just as it's never persuaded anyone, just as the special rapporteur for executions confirmed and numerous senators and Congress members and our own CIA confirmed that it's impossible that this could have taken place without Mohammed bin Salman's instruction and orders. The planes on which the henchmen were flown to Istanbul, we now have confirmed as of yesterday, as of some documents that the Saudi government apparently erroneously filed in a lawsuit it's brought against a former political official in Canada, that MBS sequestered the airline Sky Prime, if I'm getting the name right, from its owners, and then used those planes to transport the killers shortly after confiscating the assets to his state-controlled property under the public investment fund that he's the chairman of. There are just too many elements of smoking guns tying him, directly implicating him in the murder, that frankly is not plausible. But I should note that it, given that he has accepted responsibility, which is welcome, then of course under any body of law, whether domestic or international, there need to be consequences, because the responsibility of someone like him is to know or should have known, and he should have known, and his failure to have controlled his security forces from using state property and assets to carry out this murder would still be culpable, for which he should face consequences.
Well, I remember hearing at the time, and I'm not entirely sure, I take it the leaks came from the Turkish intelligence services, who apparently had the consulate pretty thoroughly wired, and they had audio of everything. And have you heard that the extent to which maybe MBS was actually on the phone during the actual murder itself? There were also other reports that maybe literally the head of Khashoggi ended up back in Saudi Arabia like a trophy. I mean, you know, the whole thing was pretty medieval to begin with. Is there anything to those rumors?
I don't know, honestly. I don't know. And there are also rumors that the DNI report will not include the actual text communications, which, of course, would be very disappointing and we will challenge and fight against. But it's hard to say conclusively without hearing or seeing the evidence.
Well, what do we know about Erdogan's position here? I mean, he's not the most trustworthy person, but it's pretty clear that they had pretty extensive intelligence coverage of the event itself. What games are they playing?
Well, I mean, certainly there has been a cold war between Saudi Arabia and Turkey and UAE, of course, even more significantly for quite a while. And the Turkish government certainly milked the fact of the execution in Istanbul in as embarrassing a fashion as I think they could have achieved. And of course, they have an ongoing trial in absentia, of course, against the culprits in Turkey that has not concluded. So I'm sure they will be using the evidence that the DNI report produces for their own lawsuit. So it's a very live and hostile relationship between Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And of course, it's been playing out on numerous fronts, most recently in Qatar, where, of course, Turkey sent troops to Qatar in the wake of the Saudi-imposed embargo. And the threats to invade Qatar that the UAE and Saudi Arabia both made.
Yeah, well, that tripwire of Turkish troops, I think, prevented that very invasion, which before that happened, there's a lot of evidence, I don't know whether you call it evidence or rumors about what went on in terms of Jared Kushner giving MBS the green light to go ahead and do it, and the extent to which Jared Kushner and his family were shaking down the Qataris for money to bail them out of 666 Fifth Avenue, and they were turned down. And then apparently Trump didn't realize that Qatar had hosted the biggest U.S. Air Force base, and General Mattis and others had to educate him about that. And then, of course, at the end of the day, it was the Qataris that ended up bailing out 666 Fifth Avenue through a real estate investment company that they are the biggest shareholders in, the Canadian company. So those ties are pretty murky and pretty obvious too, aren't they? Let's face it, the first trip abroad that Trump took was to Saudi Arabia, not exactly a tradition of American diplomacy.
No, and I think that the Kushners and the Mnuchins and the Trumps of this world are only inviting further speculation and further smearing of the reputation of the U.S. government with their financial shenanigans, some of which you've just alluded to, and without any of the normal transparency that we would come to expect. I mean, we know that the intelligence agencies of the United States and the State Department worked very hard to block Kushner from having the security clearances that he was able to have almost throughout the term of the presidency, from his personal informal communications with Mohammed bin Salman, including reports that he provided names of political exiles who had had meetings with the State Department, Saudi political exiles, endangering them. And the timing of the announcement just 2 days ago of Mnuchin setting up an investment fund in the Gulf to be funded by Gulf investors, just couldn't be more distasteful and unseemly in the wake of all of the allegations of self-dealing and fraud by the Trump administration, on the heels of this report coming out, with remaining question marks about what Jared Kushner and what Trump knew about the planned murder and then the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. I mean, it's terrible timing for Mnuchin, and I hope that this release of the DNI report is not the end of the disclosures, but the beginning of the disclosures, because there is a lot more that needs to be dug into.
And of course, Mnuchin is actually not so much dealing with Gulf and Saudi investors, but dealing with the Gulf and Saudi sovereign funds, which MBS certainly controls the Saudi sovereign fund. And his last act before he left office was to take a little tour of the neighborhood to set up these deals. That was done on yours and my dime, Sarah, I might add.
Let's chalk it up to the rampant corruption of the Trump administration that, like MBS, treated the U.S. government and the U.S. government's assets as their personal property to be used and disposed of as they personally saw fit.
Well, just in the last minute, did Biden give the Saudis like a 24-hour deadline before the report came out? What was it, just in closing, when should we expect to get this declassified DNI report?
My speculation is as good as yours, probably, in that, we're very much expecting it to come out tomorrow. If they don't release it tomorrow, it will create a bigger, even bigger fiasco, because it will very obviously seem as if they're continuing to protect MBS, exactly contrary to the campaign promises that Biden has made. As it is, this report should have been released on day one of Biden's administration. He could have issued an executive order to release it even before Avril Haines was on board or settled into her office, or what other excuses we've been hearing for the past few weeks. And now, when we were told it was coming today, and now they've announced that it's going to be delayed, which means that they've acknowledged that it was supposed to come out today, it will just smack of protectionism. And I can't imagine the Biden administration wants to give us that impression.
Well, Sara Lee Woodson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Sara Lee Woodson, who's the Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, Dawn, a U.S. organization founded by Jamal Khashoggi shortly before his murder. And Dawn and Khashoggi's widow have an active civil suit against Mohammed bin Salman for Khashoggi's murder. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Biden has only 2 years to get things done. And unless the Democrats get rid of the filibuster, the Republicans will sabotage any progress and regain the House and Senate in 2022.
Senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Adam Gentleton, who's the Executive Director of the Battleborne Collective and a former Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Harry Reid, a columnist for GQ and a frequent political commentator on MSNBC. He's the author of the new book just out, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Gentleton.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I take it that you feel, based upon your recent article in the New York Times, that Joe Biden may only have 2 years to get things done. There is a sort of built-in sabotage in the pattern of government we've had. If you go back, for example, to Mitch McConnell's vow to make Barack Obama a one-term president, the idea is that you just stonewall, use the filibuster, and then you brand the incumbent government, the do-nothing government, and the reason they're doing nothing is that you won't let them do anything. And then 2 years or 4 years later, you go to the people and say, you know, vote for us because these other people get nothing done. Is that in the cards now in these next 2 years that essentially the Democrats will be sabotaged?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it is in the cards. I do think that is going to be Republicans' strategy, is simply to deny Democrats cooperation for most of Biden's agenda. I think that's just a function of the political environment we live in right now, where the side that's out of power succeeds politically by making the side in power look bad. And, you know, on one level, it's a very rational political calculus for Republicans. If Biden fails to deliver on the big promises that he's made, voters will be more inclined to vote for Republican in the upcoming midterms. I think that calculation is further compounded by the fact that Republicans are very close to retaking the majorities in the House and Senate in the upcoming midterms. They only need to win one seat in the Senate and a handful in the House. So I think that even if they, you know, on the merits were inclined to want to work with Democrats on issues that they care about, I think the political overwhelms the policy here and will drive them to obstruct Biden just as they did to President Obama.
Well, judging about what's happening at the state level with Republican legislatures drawing up maps to gerrymander extra seats in Texas and Arizona and Georgia and Florida, the Republicans will take the House before one vote is even cast.
That's right. I think that this is part of why I tried to express some urgency in the piece you mentioned, which is that, you know, it was wonderful for me as a Democrat to see President Biden get elected. It was wonderful to see Democrats take back the Senate by winning the Georgia runoffs. But time is of the essence. And, you know, in addition to the factors you mentioned, Democrats' majority in the Senate hangs by a single seat. And, you know, I don't want to be macabre about it, but you've got a chamber with a lot of folks who are up there in age, and one illness or something worse could potentially hand the majority right back to Republicans. I don't mean to be grim about it, but that's the reality. And I think that we need to face up to that. The window to pass the big things that Biden has proposed could be very, very short. And I think that he needs to act with the urgency that would suggest.
Well, obviously, the Biden situation is he's hanging by a thread there. And he's also got on the Democratic side a couple of wavering Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who apparently don't think getting rid of the filibuster is a good idea. It's hard to understand why any Democrat would think that way, given what happened with the assault on Capitol Hill and the undemocratic nature of this coup attempt, where, what was it, 81 million Americans basically were going to have their votes taken away, my vote included. There's been no retribution on the part of the Republicans. In fact, they exonerated the president who tried to steal the majority of our votes and invalidate the election. So it's a very toxic situation. Do you think that Manchin and Sinema understand the grave nature of this? And is it clear what their problem is with getting rid of the filibuster?
I think there's two reasons. One is, I think that they think that by supporting the filibuster and opposing its elimination, they are standing in the way of far-left policies like Medicare for All, or in Manchin's case, a Green New Deal. He's from West Virginia. He is pro-coal. He doesn't want to see that kind of legislation pass. I think that what they're going to see over time is that by standing up for the filibuster, they're standing against most of Biden's agenda overall, and that by keeping the filibuster in place, it means that virtually nothing is going to pass. And I think that's going to become an untenable situation for them. If they were just blocking Medicare for All or the Green New Deal, I think the politics would work well for them, especially for Manchin, who comes from a deeply red state. But I think blocking Biden's agenda, which is very, very popular, is not going to be a sustainable stance for them. The other thing that I think, and it's been interesting to me as a longtime observer of this issue to see, is that I think they expected there to be more of a cheering section for their position. But it's been fascinating to watch sort of consensus rapidly form around the idea of eliminating the filibuster. You know, not everybody's there yet, but you have conservative commentators like David Brooks, former Bush speechwriter David Frum, come out and say, essentially, you know, if Republicans continue to obstruct Democrats, then yeah, they should get rid of the filibuster. So I think that that cheering section that Manchin and Sinema expected to be there for their position doesn't exist, and they're much more out on a limb than they thought they would be, and they're quickly going to find themselves standing in the way of most of President Biden's agenda and the political success of their fellow Democrats in 2022. And I think ultimately that's going to be an unsustainable position for them.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Gentleson, who is the executive director of the Battle Born Collective and a former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid, a columnist for GQ and a frequent political commentator on MSNBC. He's the author of the new book just out, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. But I think it's fair, surely, Adam, to suggest that the Republicans are not threatened. I'm talking about the Senate. The Republicans are not threatened by the filibuster because they're basically interested in tax cuts for the rich and deregulation, neither of which require the 60-vote threshold. Whereas the Democrats, who want to deal with the problems that the country's facing, and they're particularly acute now with a pandemic and with an economy in freefall, their legislation, most of it, except for what they're doing with this COVID-19 package, the $1.9 trillion, which they're doing through reconciliation. Just about everything else, and most importantly, HR1 and SB1 and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which will then, you know, change the, well, revive American democracy in many ways, none of those will get anywhere. So is this do the Democrats recognize the asymmetry here, where the filibuster favors the Republicans because they don't really want to pass anything? They don't seem to have any agenda apart from tax cuts for the rich and deregulation, whereas almost everything that the Democrats have promised their voters and want to do are stymied by the 60-vote threshold.
I think they are recognizing the asymmetry. I frankly think that what you're seeing on the COVID relief package is helping Democrats come to that realization very quickly. You know, if Republicans won't come across the aisle and support a bill as urgently needed as this, that happens to be polling in upwards of 70% support of the American people, then I think Democrats are left to conclude that Republicans won't join them on anything. And, you know, Republicans would rather maintain the ability to block things than they would to join even in popular legislation. I also think the experience of the Trump years was somewhat instructive, because Republicans campaigned for 7 years on the idea that they were going to repeal Obamacare. When Trump won in the first years of his administration, when Republicans controlled everything in Washington, they had the opportunity to repeal Obamacare. And since they pursued this process through the reconciliation process, they were able to do so at a simple majority threshold and defang the filibuster. The Democrats were unable to use the filibuster to stop the repeal of Obamacare. Despite all this, Republicans couldn't do it. They couldn't muster a majority, let alone 60 votes. They couldn't even get to 50 votes to repeal Obamacare. The reason was that it was simply politically unpopular to do so. And I think what that shows is that even if you restored majority rule in the Senate, it would be very difficult for Republicans to undo a lot of the things that Democrats pass, for the simple reason that those things are popular. It is much harder to take things away from the American people once you've given them something that they like. You know, for many Americans, they didn't realize how much they liked Obamacare until it was threatened to be taken away from them. So I think the fear that if you restore majority rule, that you'd have this whiplash where Democrats would pass things and Republicans would undo them, is not going to play out in practice. And I think the Obamacare episode is a pretty good indication of that.
And of course, we all remember John McCain's thumbs down on that particular vote. Since you worked in the Senate, Adam Gentleson, as Deputy Chief of Staff for Senator Harry Reid, when did this modern sort of easy form of filibuster take place? And we're all, of course, remember the, not all, but a lot of people remember the Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith comes to Washington, the idea that you have to really put some skin in the game and talk yourself for hours and hours and hours. And I don't know how you get around a bathroom break, but that was the notion we had of what a filibuster was. But now you can basically phone it in. Just one senator can phone it in. Is that how it is?
Yes, that is how it is today. And it's more powerful than the Jimmy Stewart version, because in the Jimmy Stewart version, like you said, you actually had to stand there physically and hold the floor. So you could only delay something for as long as you were able to hold the floor yourself. Or, you know, maybe you had a few allies who could help you. But, you know, we're talking somewhere in the range of, you know, days, maybe weeks at the most. And even that was considered a powerful tool. Today, it's much more powerful because senators don't have to hold the floor. They don't have to put any effort into it. But what they can do is not just delay a bill, but actually increase the number of votes that it takes to pass a bill. In the Jimmy Stewart days, bills still passed or failed based on whether they could muster a majority support in the Senate. That's the way the Senate operated for the vast majority of its existence from its founding all the way up through basically through the 1970s, 1980s, and a little bit into the 1990s. More recently, the norm has come to be accepted that things take 60 votes to pass, but this is a recent development. And the way you impose that 60-vote threshold is what we would now call a filibuster, but you don't have to go to the floor to speak to impose that higher threshold. You can just send an email. In fact, you, the senator, don't actually have to send the email yourself. You can have a member of your staff send the email. And with that single email, the number of votes that it takes to pass whatever bill you're opposing goes up from a simple majority to 60 votes. in our polarized environment, it is almost impossible for most bills to get 60 votes. And the incentive that we discussed before exists for the minority to say, well, I don't actually wouldn't mind if this bill passed, but it would be really great if I blocked it because that would make the party in power look bad. So all of that has sort of converged in recent years to make the Senate something fundamentally different from what it was before, which is a body that doesn't require you to speak, doesn't require you to debate, but still allows you to silently increase the number of votes that it takes to pass a bill from a majority up to 60 votes. And that is enough to kill most bills in today's polarized environment.
Well, just one senator, and Rand Paul seems to sort of take a sadistic pleasure in being the least popular person in the Senate chamber, although I believe that Ted Cruz is vying for that particular honor. Doesn't it invite that kind of obstruction, that just one person who just has a jaundiced view of things could hold the entire United States government hostage?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, the Senate used to strike a better balance between the need to protect the minority from being steamrolled by the majority and balancing that out with the need to actually get things done. Today, our Senate has gotten skewed dramatically in favor of allowing the minority and, as you say, even one senator themselves to throw a monkey wrench into the gears of government. And we've lost sight of the need to actually act on the problems that we face today. You know, I want to underscore, you know, part of the reason the framers didn't include the filibuster in the Senate, and part of the reason they made it a majority rule body, is that they placed a big premium on actually getting things done. And that's what we've lost sight of today. We've come to, in our debate, I think we tend to overvalue the idea of the protection of minority rights. The framers thought that was important, but essentially what they wanted to do was give the minority the ability to have a voice in the process and to express themselves and to make sure the majority never steamrolled them without the minority getting to have a say. But they never intended the minority to be able to stop the majority from acting altogether. They wanted the majority to have to sit and listen to the minority. They wanted to make sure the minority's voices would be heard in the process. But when that was done, after a reasonable amount of time, if the minority failed to persuade the other side to come over to their side, then it was time to act and the majority should rule. And they were extremely clear about this. And we need to get back to that more productive balance between minority rights and majority rule.
And this is the book of the moment, Adam, because we talked about the gerrymandering that's already underway, where the Republicans could pick up House seats simply from the gerrymandering that's now going on with the state legislatures, and they would pick up the House without one vote being cast. And, of course, the idea has always been that voters choose their representatives, not their representatives choosing their voters. But that's the situation we have with the House and with the Senate. By 2040, 30% of the country will choose 70% of the senators, all in red states. And then you've got another relic of the Jim Crow era, the Electoral College, where in the last election, had Trump won 43,000 more votes in just three of those swing states, it would have been tied in the Electoral College, and then he would have been awarded the presidency through the majority of Republicans in state legislatures. So we are hanging by a thread on all of the above, right? So the idea that we have so much built into our Constitution and our governance that's structurally, essentially, the tyranny of the minority. So it's not just that Biden's got such a small window to get things done, but in general, isn't this the time for the Democrats to go bold, or otherwise the decks are stacked against them into the future?
That's exactly right. And I agree, it is absolutely time for Democrats to go bold. And, you know, the situation you laid out is exactly why we don't need the filibuster. You know, we have a system of checks and balances. There are many other parts of our system of government that are in place to ensure that the minority is not steamrolled by the majority. That's why the framers didn't create the filibuster. It was created later, invented primarily for the interest of oppressing Black Americans. It was not part of the original Senate. It needs to go so that we can actually get things done. And, you know, the other aspect I would raise is that all of the problems that you just mentioned, you know, the solutions to them will all be blocked by the filibuster if it remains in place. We need to pass things like SB1, HR1, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. We need to pass things like statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico. And none of those things will happen if the filibuster remains in place. There is no way 10 Republicans are ever going to cross over and vote for those things. So not only is it necessary for Biden to actually enact his agenda, it's also necessary to address and start to fix some of these structural inequities that tilt the playing field dramatically towards conservatives. And as long as the filibuster remains in place, that playing field will be tilted dramatically towards conservatives and will probably continue tilting even more in the coming years.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Adam Gentleson.
Thank you very much for having us. Great to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Gentleson, who's the executive director of the Battle Born Collective and a former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid. He's a columnist for GQ and a frequent commentator on MSNBC, and is the author of the new book just out, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy.
You've been listening to Background Briefing with Ian Masters. Ian has been filling in for me today as I recover from the surgery, and I'll be back on Monday. Stay tuned for Janelle. She's coming up next right here on WMNF in Tampa. And you can hear Ian Masters every afternoon at 4 o'clock on WMNF's HD3 channel, which is our all-news and public affairs and talk channel, HD3. Easy to get to. Just go to wmnf.org/listen, and that's where you hear all sorts of great programs like the Tom Hartman program. Coming up in just a few seconds, the latest news from NPR.